This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Imagine a New Yorker cartoon. Zen teacher comes into the Zendo in the morning and sees all the seats are empty. And he turns to his attendant and says, "Where are all my monks?" The attendant replies, "It's Yom Kippur." So even though we seem to have our usual group here with us this morning, despite the holiday, thought I would use the occasion to talk about our sense of Buddhism as a religion versus a practice, and talk about that in light of the Jukai ceremonies that we will conduct next weekend during Sesshin at Garrison. See, as the joke implies, in American Zen, almost everybody has grown up in a different religious family other than Buddhism, but they can't quite be called convert Buddhists to distinguish them from Asian Buddhists who've grown up as Buddhists, because by and large most Americans don't consider themselves to have converted to Buddhism. They'll usually describe it as that they're practicing Buddhism or practicing mindfulness or Zen. Yet the Jukai ceremony is essentially a ceremony of conversion. If you wanted to talk about what it meant to convert to Buddhism, you would talk about receiving the precepts. And one does that in a lay lineage without home leaving and without shaving of the head and putting on robes, but it's still taking a certain kind of commitment, identifying with a certain tradition, reorienting yourself, re-identifying yourself in terms of the precepts. Now, that's not the only way to think about receiving Jukai. And in fact, part of the process of preparing for Jukai is really spending time and study to examine each person's own particular sense of their relationship to the tradition. How do you see yourself in relation to Buddhism, in relation to a Sangha? What exactly are you committing to? What exactly are you joining? One of the ways we prepare for Jukai is that we shift our practice away from being an individual practice, away from thinking that practice is what's going on in our heads while we sit, or what's happening in our knees as we sit, and how we deal with our thought and our pain in our own particular individual practice. We expand that to take over various roles in the Zendo, particularly being Jikido, and becoming responsible for the way the Zendo operates, being responsible for giving instructions to newcomers, for organization and care of the place, and making sure that the service and the ceremonies run smoothly. The practice becomes oriented outward rather than inward. You can say it's an attempt to put the emphasis on interdependency and connection rather than the realization of one's own self-nature, as if that's something you could realize independently. Now, there are lots of different ways to think about what we do as a Sangha. In the verse we just chanted, we speak of this Dharma as something that now we can see, hear, hold, and maintain. And that picture, a very traditional picture, is one that imagines the Dharma as something essentially timeless, that is passed down generation to generation. And it is now our generation's responsibility to care for it, maintain it, and pass it on to the next generation intact. Sometimes you have the image of a candle, where the flame of the candle is used to light the next candle and the next candle after that. And in that kind of model, it becomes irrelevant whether the candle itself is tall and thin or short and squat or what kind of wax it is. It doesn't matter. Somehow the flame is the same flame. The flame is pure and eternal and unaffected by the material substance of the candle. And so that presents the Dharma as a kind of timeless, ahistorical truth. And there is a great deal of appeal in that kind of image for people. We'd like to believe that we are in touch with something eternal and transcendent, that is temporarily manifest here or available to us, but it somehow exists in another realm. That kind of imagery is very common in Buddhism and across many religions. But particularly in our lay practice, I think we find that we have to take a somewhat ironic stance to that kind of imagery. Particularly, we have to see that as imagery that we have created to describe something about what we're doing. What we're trying to maintain, right? It would probably be truer if we chanted, now we can see it, hear it, construct it, and maintain it, right? To take responsibility for the fact that in every generation, we have the responsibility for defining for ourselves what's essential in the Dharma. What are we maintaining? What are we practicing? What do we really think we're up to? I received one of these fundraising letters from a branch of Sodoshu, the Japanese headquarters of the Soto sect. And they're very proud to announce that there is now underway a big construction project in Northern California to build an exact replica of a Japanese Soto monastery, so that Americans finally can get authentic training. And the authentic training requires not just right speech and right action and right concentration, but right architecture. In particular, the training requires a Sodo hall, S-O-D-O, a hall in which the monks live as well as meditate, so that you would be sitting on raised platforms with one drawer under your seat, down which you pull your bedding at night, and everybody lives and eats and sits in this one room. And that is the training hall. And the sense is that authentic training requires that kind of intensive, immersive living experience. Well, okay, it's certainly a way to do it. And Joko, when she ran Sesshin in San Diego, did something like that, and we'd have 40 people in the Zendo, and there was no place to anybody sleep except in the Zendo. You brought your sleeping bag and you put it out on the floor in front of your cushion, and you'd have 20 people, sleeping in the Zendo at night with one bathroom. And everybody just had to deal with each other, right? And that was part of the practice. Right? So, I've done that for many, many weeks of Sesshin with her. Does not make me want to go do it for 3 years, in a training monastery. But it's certainly a way to do it. The thing that we are facing, though, is whether it is the way to do it or a way to do it. And how we understand the nature of authenticity. Whether authenticity means creating a replica, or whether authenticity means doing the thing that is most productive and valuable and meaningful in the particular circumstance you find yourself in. See, traditions get themselves into a certain kind of trouble when they see their particular forms as in some sense fixed or God-given or essential. Sorry, but I'll make a brief byway into Hegel and say that in particular his critique of faith says that faith in one sense wants to define itself upward all the time, as if it's in touch with a higher transcendent truth, and that it's defined by inner religious experience. But it gets itself in trouble when it ignores or tries to dissociate itself from the cultural and historical roots of those experiences, the things that actually ground it in social practice and community ritual. And one, what happens then is that there's no flexibility and no responsiveness and no way to resolve conflict. And one extreme version of this he takes to be exemplified in Sophocles' play Antigone, where in the Greek culture of the time, women were in charge of the household and had a divine responsibility for things like burying the dead. This was their God-given responsibility and duty. The men had an equally God-given authority in politics over the polis. And so Antigone describes a situation where Creon, as head of the city, has decreed that the Antigone's brother, who's been a traitor and has led this revolt against him in the city, must not be given a burial. But Antigone knows, as a sister, she's absolutely determined to give him this burial. So you've got two forces, both of whom feel they have an absolute God-given duty to do the right thing, to do what they insist on, and that there's no common ground to resolve anything. This ends in a in tragedy. Not only does Antigone end up killing herself under the threat of death from Creon, but turns out Creon's son was betrothed to Antigone, and he kills himself. And when he kills himself, Creon's wife kills herself. And the whole, he is ruined and the society is ruined because you've had this unresolvable sense of absolute moral duty. And so what's lost in this picture is the sense that these duties are in any way mutually and socially constructed in the service of the society itself, in some common, in an attempt to create a bond and a sense of justice. So how I bring that back here is that sense that whenever we get too stuck on a picture of authenticity, on a picture of the absolute authority of tradition, as this is the way it's always done and the way it has to be done, we're very liable to get stuck. I think that one way American Zen got stuck is that it didn't know how to challenge the authority of enlightened masters. Students did not really own the fact that they were the source of teachers' authority, right? That this is a socially agreed upon and constructed arrangement where students empower teachers, that they wish to emulate and learn from. But if you think that a teacher's authority comes straight from God or straight from the, you know, great Satori that is unchallengeable, then everything becomes, no matter what the teacher does, no matter how badly he behaves, it can all come under the heading of some kind of crazy wisdom or teaching. There's no way to challenge anything. There's no way for the students to say, this is just destructive or nuts or I don't want any part of this, right? Someplace here the group and the students have to see that they are the empowering authority. I think that American Zen is going through lots of ongoing growing pains, where we have all these tensions between adapting to lay life and attempting to preserve and maintain traditional forms. There's a lot to be said for both ways of proceeding, but I think the important thing is for us to take responsibility for how it proceeds. Buddhism is not something that is being handed down to you, which you are passively receiving. It is yours to create, construct, hold, and maintain. Part of the notion of Jukai is to take responsibility for that.